asked.
Don't know what you mean.
You still fevered or something? Thena, been mighty strange these past few weeks, mighty strange. So what is it? What's got you?
Don't know what you mean.
All righty. Let me ask it like this. What in all of creation done possessed you to run around lockless with Nathaniel Walker's girl?
I ain't running around with nobody. Girl choose her company, sure as I chose mine.
That's what you think, huh?
Yep, that's what I think.
Then you as dumb as you seem.
What I now did was cut my eyes at Thena in a gesture I had learned from children rebellious against their parents. And I was a child. I know that now. A boy overrun with emotion, undone by a great and momentous loss. And I felt it just then, though I could not name it. I felt all that I had lost when my mother fell into that black hole of memory. Because standing before me was someone whom I stood to lose again. And I could not bear to lose her. To look her in the eye and confess my plan. To leave the only mother I had ever known. So, when I spoke, it was not with sadness or honesty, but with anger and righteousness.
What I done to you, I asked.
Huh?
Whatever in all of creation have I done to you to speak to me so?
Speak to you so, she said, and the look became almost bemused.
Hell you care about how I speak to you. You fell to me out of nothing. I never asked you for any of it. But what I do every evening after breaking my back for these folks who fry up your bacon and corn cakes, that girl ever done that for you? Who guard you against what these folks try to make of you with all their scheming? And what have I asked from you, Hiram? Whatever have I asked?
And why start now, I said. Then I fixed Thena with a long, hard stare. It was not a look fit for anyone, nor any woman who had loved me, and certainly not the woman who had so cared for me. Thena looked back at me as though I had shot her. But the pain quickly passed. It was as if her last hope that this wicked world would admit some justice, some light, had vanished before her, and what was left was the crooked end she had expected all along.
You're gonna regret all this one day, she said. You're gonna regret it more than any evil that come along with that girl. And evil will come to you, I assure you. But this moment here, when you speak as such to those who loved you when you was most frail, you gonna regret.
Then she opened the door, looking back only to say,
boy like you should be more careful with his words. Never know when they the last words he might put upon a person.
I didn't have to wait long for the promised regret to bloom inside me. But in that moment, it was overwhelmed by another portion of me. The one that thought only of my impending flight from this old world, with its dying land, its fearful slaves, and its low and vulgar whites. I would leave it all behind for the freedom of the underground, and made no exception for Thena. The remaining days passed until finally it came. The morning of Georgie's fateful promise came like life itself, long and quick. I woke to that day filled with unease. I lay awake in my bed, hoping that the day might remain there with me, but then I heard the shuffling of the Warrens and the hum of the house above, and this awful music announced that the day was a fact, and my promise was a fact, and it could not be backed away from. So I rose to the darkness and walked with my earthen jar toward the well and saw Pete on my way there, already dressed and on his way to the garden, and I remember this because it was the last time I ever saw him. Outside in the distance I saw Thena at the well, all alone, drawing water for laundry. It was such hard work, hauling up the water, firing up the wood, beating the garments, preparing the soap, and she did all of it. I remember standing there, knowing how I had wronged her, scorned her, heaped on disrespect, feeling the sharp shame of it, and beating it back with my anger, with my, who does she think she is? I waited for her to finish, and watched from the tunnel as this old colored woman hauled the water all alone, knowing even then that I would regret this, that for the rest of my life, those last words to Thena, when I stood apart from her, would haunt me. When all was clear, I walked to the well and filled my own gourd, then walked back and cleaned myself and dressed. I came to the mouth of the tunnel and watched the sun come up over Loch Ness, and for one final, weighty moment pondered the step now standing before me. I thought of oceans and all the explorers of whom I had read during those long summer Sundays in the library, and I wondered what they had felt stepping up off the land and onto the deck, looking out over the sea, the waves, which they must cross into some unknown realm. I wondered if fear took them, if they ever were compelled to run back into the arms of their women, to kiss their young daughters and remain there among them in the world they knew. Or were they like me, aware that the world they loved was uncertain, that it too must fade before time, that change was the rule of everything, that if they did not cross the water must soon cross over them. So I must go, for my world was disappearing, had always been disappearing. Maynard called out from the Goose, Corrine from the mountains, and above all, Natchez. I jogged myself out of the reverie. I walked up the stairs and spoke with my father, who had now found a task for me. Work in the kitchen with the remains of the waitstaff, beginning tomorrow. One last day of freedom, he said. But I was, by then, past any care for such things. I simply nodded, and then assessed him for any sign that he had caught on. But he was cheerful, more cheerful than I'd seen him in weeks. He spoke of Corrine Quinn, and her promise to visit later that week, and I felt an incredible relief at that fact, that I would by then be gone. I walked to the library. I thumbed through the old volumes of Ramsay and Morton. Then I walked back down toward my quarters. For the rest of the day, I kept out of sight. I could not bear to eat. I could not bear to see anyone else. I was by then done with all the reminiscences and fantasy. What I most wanted was for the appointed moment to come. And it did, I tell you. It did. The sun set, bringing on the long winter night, and then the house quieted and the hum of the day faded until all that was left was the occasional creaking. I brought nothing with me save ambition, not clothes, not victuals, not books, not even my coin, which I now pulled from the pocket of my overalls, rubbed one last time, and deposited on the mantel. I met Sophia at the edge of the peach grove. We used the road to mark our path, but stayed in the woods, out of sight, in case we were spotted by any of the patrols. We talked and laughed in our normal, easy way, but with lowered voices, until the road bent and then, in the distance, we saw the bridge across the Goose. And feeling that this was the moment, the place from which none would dare turn back, we were quiet, struck dumb by fear and awe. We stood there looking out at the bridge, which was but a long, dark span against the greater dark of the night. I heard the creeping things of the earth calling out to each other. The night was starless and overcast. So, it's freedom, then, I said. Freedom, she said. Mend it or rip it. No more treating, no more in between. Die young or not at all. And so we walked out from the woods and onto the path, and in the open view of the night. I took her hand, and I was aware that her hand was steady and mine trembled. We had put our lives on the honor of Georgie Parks. We believed in the rumor in the underground. We crossed and did not look back, and made for the woods, steering clear of Starfall. I had, in the days prior, taken time to wander among the back paths, and had found a way to bring us to Georgie's meeting place with both speed and discretion. When we reached the small pond where Georgie and I had stood 1 week earlier, we relaxed a bit. "What will you do when you get there?" I asked.
"Don't know," she said. "Don't know what a gal do in a swamp. Would like to work for my own. That is my highest ambition. How about you?"
"Get as far as I might from you, I figured." We both laughed.
"You know you crazy," I said. "Got me out here running. I say if we make it through, when we make it through, I will have had all I need of Sophia's schemings.
Uh-huh. Might be nice to lighten my own load, Sophia said. Men ain't brought me and mine nothing but a heap of trouble.
We laughed a little more. I looked up at the starless sky, then looked over to Sophia, who was backing away, backing toward the pond. And then I heard footsteps and conversation, and I could tell that whoever was approaching us was not alone. I thought to hide then, but I distinctly heard Georgie's voice among the men, and this stayed me. Then the voices went quiet, and all we heard were the footsteps crunching against the ground. I took Sophia's hand and looked through the opening in the wood. I saw the darkness framing the figure of Georgie Parks. I smiled. I remember that. And I tell you, as I have always, that I remember everything, but here, perhaps, I am playing tricks upon myself because it was a starless night, and I could not see Sophia as little more than a silhouette before me. But I swear that I remember seeing the face of Georgie Parks, and his face was pained and was sad, and I did not know why. And then I heard the footsteps again, and I saw five white men emerge, one by one from the darkness, and I saw that one of them carried a rope between his hands. And when they were out, they stood before us for what seemed like forever. And I heard Sophia moan,
"No, no, no."
And then I watched one of the men touch Georgie's shoulder and say,
"All right, Georgie, you done good."
And at that, Georgie turned his back on us and walked back into the forest. And these men with their rope turned to us.
"No, no, no," moaned Sophia.
I swear they were like phantoms, glowing against the night like specters, and I knew by their outline and bearing exactly what they were. Chapter 9. Ryland's hounds brought us up by pistol point, brought us through that moonless and starless night, through a darkness thick enough to touch, thick as the ropes knotted around our hands. And I was suddenly aware of the cold, of the wind swinging like a sword, so that I began to shiver, and this became a fact of great amusement for our captors. And though I could not see them, I could hear them laughing at me, mocking me.
"Time for shivering past, boy."
For they took me to be in fear of what they might do. It was true that Ryland's hounds were fearsome, and the fact that I was not in total terror can only be attributed to the flight of emotions, shame, anger, shock, that now raced ahead of fear. They could have done anything to us out there, done anything to her, for this was the normal path of things. It was the necessary right of the low, who held no property in man, to hold momentary property in those who ran, and to vent all their awful passions upon them. And from the moment I saw Georgie disappear and Ryland float out of the woods like wraiths, I felt that this venting must come. But it did not. They just led us out of the woods into Starfall until we were at the jail, and there they replaced rope with chains and left us in the yard like the animals they took us to be, dressed in cold irons, for what must be our last moments together, our last moments upon this earth as we knew it. I remember the heaving weight of the chains, a center line extending from the collar around my neck down to a smaller chain and cuffs around my wrists, through another chain and cuffs clapped around my ankles. And this lattice of cold iron was looped around the bottom rail of the fence that bracketed the jail, so that I could neither straighten my back nor take a seat for relief, and was thus permanently stooped. All my life, I had been a captive. But whereas the particulars of my birth had allowed me to feel this bondage as a mark or symbol, there was nothing symbolic in this hulking web. I could angle my neck in one direction, and there I found pain of a different sort, for I caught sight of Sophia, fastened just as I was, perhaps a few yards away. I wanted so bad to say something as radical as I felt the moment then demanded. I wanted to tell her of my great sorrow at having led her into this deeper, truer slavery. I wanted to hold myself to her account for this great betrayal, but when I spoke, I had nothing but the most impoverished of words.
I am sorry, I said. I had turned my head back down to the ground. I am so very sorry. Sophia did not answer. What I badly wanted right then was a blade, and with it I would slit my own throat. I could not live knowing what I had done, what I had brought to Sophia, and it was so very cold out there. I could feel my hands turning to rock and my ears disappearing into the night, and I knew I was crying, because I felt those quiet tears freezing on my cheeks. At that moment, lost in my own shame, I heard a low, rhythmic grunting, and I saw that with each grunt the bottom rail of the fence shook a little. And now looking over, I saw that it was Sophia who was grunting. She was pulling the weight of the chains and one foot at a time sliding closer and closer. For what, I could not be sure. Perhaps she wanted to be closer so that she might whisper some ancient curse or rend one of my ears between her teeth. She moved with great force, and with her every upward heave, the rail heaved with her. I had no idea she was this strong. She began slowly, breaking between each slide, but as she approached, the heaves became faster and greater, so that I thought her plan might be to snap the railing itself and free us. But when she reached me, she stopped, exhausted, panting from her great effort, and she was close enough that I could see all of her features, and she looked upon me, tender at first, so tender that, at least for that moment, my shame slid away. Then, straining against the chains, she angled her head forward a bit, past the fence, past the jail, and though I could not see it, I knew that her indication was aimed toward Freetown. And she looked back at me, and what I saw was a look so hard that I knew that she too wished for a knife, though the throat she wanted it for would not be her own. Now I saw her face tighten and her teeth bare down. Sophia gave one last heave until she was right next to me, so close that I could feel her breath on my cheek and her arm close against mine, so close that she could lean in against me, as she did now, so close that I could feel her warmth, so close that icy darkness retreated, and I shivered no more. Part 2. Were I to tell you the evils of slavery, I should wish to take you one at a time and whisper them to you. William Wells Brown. Chapter 10. Ryland's jail was my home now. Sophia was parted from me the next day, for where, I did not know. Sold to the fancy trade, sent back to Nathaniel, Natchez. And what I was left with was that portrait of her, which I see even now, fighting against the chains for that moment of contact, focusing her hateful gaze, not inward, not on me, not on herself, but on the base treachery of Georgie Parks. Even then I did not know how deep the treachery went. But I knew enough to husband a hate thick as winter stew. Later, years and years later, I would understand the impossibility of Georgie's standing, the way the quality had narrowed his choices until he lived on a thin, chancy reed called Freetown. But just then, I hated him and suckered myself on the miraculous notion that Georgie would someday be subject to my wrath. I was thrown into a dank cell, with a filthy cover and straw pallet for bedding, and a bucket for relief. Each day I was brought out early, made to exercise, and then washed. Blacking was applied to my hair, oil to my body. And then I was made to stand with all the others stripped down to my skin in the front parlor of the jail. The flesh traders, vultures of Natchez, entered and had their way with me. They were a ghastly sight, the lowest of low whites, because, unlike their brethren, these men, while originating in that bottom file, had grown wealthy from the flesh trade, but seemed to revel in their debased roots, their slovenly dress, their missing teeth, their foul odors, their habit of spitting tobacco wherever they wished as a kind of absurd show. The quality shunned them, for slave trading was still held as a disreputable business. They did not host the traders in their homes nor invite them into their Sunday pews. Time would come when gold would outweigh blood. But this was still Virginia of old, where a dubious god held that those who would offer a man for sale were somehow more honorable than those who effected that sale. This shunning caused a great resentment in the traders, a resentment they vented on us. They took glee in their work, so that in that parlor they seemed to dance as they approached, and when they gripped at my buttocks to check their firmness, they did it with vim and vigor. And when they twisted my jaw in the light, checking my skull against their theories of phrenology, they never failed to smile a little. And when they stuck their fingers in my mouth, probing for rotten teeth, or struck my limbs, searching for old injuries, they hummed a melody to themselves. I would fall into myself during these examinations, because I quickly learned that the only way to survive such invasion was to dream, to let my soul fly from my body, fly back to Lochless, and another time when I called out the work songs, "Be back, Gina, with my heart and my song," or stood before Alice Cawley, watching her gleam as I recited her history, or sat under the gazebo, passing a jug of ale and nursing all my wants and desires. But it was only a dream. And the fact was, I was there in the awful now, being handled by men who gloried in their power to reduce a man to meat. So I was now under it, down in the coffin of slavery, because whatever I had endured back at Lochless, it must be said, was not this and was nothing like what surely was to come. And I was not alone. There were two others in my cell. The first was a boy with light brown hair, barely 12, I guessed, a boy who did not smile and never spoke and maintained the hardened aspect of a man long tasked. But he was a boy, a fact revealed at night by the fearful whimper in his sleep, by his small yawn in the morning. Each night after our supper of scraps, his mother called on him, and I guessed from her garments, which were above the heavy Osnaburg of the tasked, that she was free, but had somehow lost possession of her child. She would sit on the floor outside the cell holding his hand through the iron bars, and they would pass the moments silently, hand in hand, until Ryland dismissed her. There was something achingly familiar in this ritual, something that an old, forgotten part of me recognized, like a scene from some other unrecalled life. My other cellmate was an old man. His face was lined by the ages, and upon the ocean of his back I saw the many voyages of Ryland's whip. Whatever my miseries during that time in Ryland's jail, nothing I endured approached what was put on this old man. The math of profit shielded me and the boy. But this old man, his days of use, over, with only pennies to be wrung for him, was meat for the dogs. At any moment in the day, whenever the mood struck, these men would pull the old man out and compel him to sing, dance, crawl, bark, cluck, or perform some other indignity. And should his performance dissatisfy any of them, they would wail on him with fists and boots, beat him with horse reins or carriage whips, hurl paperweights and chairs at him, or reach for whatever else was at hand. And I felt the rawest shame beholding this, though I did not recognize it as such, shame in myself in having no ability whatsoever to help. These were dark times of the soul. My sympathy for these two was quickly swallowed by the sense that it was these same dumb sympathies that had brought me to this moment. My mind was frantic with suspicion. Perhaps it was all conspiracy. Maybe Sophia was in on it. Perhaps Thina had warned them. Maybe they were all sitting up somewhere, laughing with Corrine Quinn, laughing with my father even, at my foolish dreams of freedom. And so shame and sympathy quickly gave way to a hardness that has never left me. It was night. I was lying on the damp stone floor. The little boy's mother was gone. I could hear Ryland up front in a drunken game of poker. Tonight the old man, for some reason, felt the need to speak. His voice came to me in the darkness. He first told me in a croaked whisper that I reminded him of his son. I ignored him and tried to snuggle between my pallet of straw and a moth-eaten blanket, looking for any warmth I could find. And so he said it again, in a tone that communicated the privileges of his age.
"Doubtful," I responded. "Doubtful that you are him, certainly," he said. "But I have marked you, and know that you are about his age and bear that taint that he must surely wear. We are parted from each other, but at night when I dream of him, I dream of a man betrayed, and that man wears a look much like you."
I said nothing.
"How you come here?" he asked.
"By way of flight," I said. "I ran from the task and took with me another man's fancy."
"But they ain't kill you," he said, wholly unmoved. "Must be some task still to be gotten from you, though likely in another country where none know your name and your boastful sin shall strike them as the lies of a man shackled and diminished."
"Why they lay it on you so?" I asked.
"Amusement, I suppose," he said.
He chuckled in the dark at this.
"I'm about ready for the ox," he said. "Can't you tell?"
"No different than the rest of us," I said.
"Not you, not yet, and not that one over there,"
he said, waving at the boy.
"Yes, indeed. A homecoming is calling me back to my peoples. I know I am fated to die here in torment, for I am wholly dressed in the worst of sin."
He was now into it, and though it was night, I could see the old man sitting up and staring out toward the parlor, where we could see lantern light licking back shadows from the other room, and could still hear Rylan exploding into occasional laughter. Now and then the little boy's soft breath curled into a light snore.
"I lived as I should," he said, "but I did not live alone. And when I found myself out there, the last man with no society to enforce true law, I knew that my time had come. The world is moving on without this here country. Time was that Elm County was like the only son, best loved by the Lord. Time was this country was the height of society, and the white people was all regale and splendor, grand balls and gossip. I was there. I was out very often on the riverboat with my master. I saw how they made revelry. You are born into these fallen years, but I remember when they lived feast to feast, their tables heaving under fine breads, quail and currant cakes, claret, cider, and all other manner of delights. None of it for us, I grant you, but we had our gifts. Our gift was the steady land under our feet. That was a time when a good man could make himself a family and could witness his children and children's children the same. Our granddaddy saw it all. Yes, he did. Brought here from Africa. He found the Lord. He found a wife, and generations came under his survey. It was not our season, but the season was so certain, such that even a Tashkin man could count out the steps of his life. I could tell you stories, boy. I could tell you about the races and the day Planet flew out his shoes. But never mind it. You have asked me why they put it upon me so, and I will tell you."
I had heard the stories before. It had become common to package the feeling of those days, the relative solace taken in knowing one's mother and having cousins on the nearby estate, of holidays that still stand tall in memory. But that solace is not freedom, and one can be certain but never be secure. It was the certain system that gave Sophia to Nathaniel that made me. There was no peace in slavery, for every day under the rule of another is a day of war. "What is your name?" I asked the old man.
"What do it matter?" he said. "What matters is that I loved a woman. And in that love, I forgot my name. That was my sin, the cause by which I am found here." with you, and with this boy, and left to the mercies of these low-down whites.
He was trying to stand now, using the iron bars to pull himself up. I stood to help, but he waved me off. He managed to lean against the bars with his left arm looped through for support.
I was wedded as a young man, and lived for a great many years in all the happiness that a man and a woman might ever hope to know. We lived among the task, you see, but the task never lived in us. We had a son. He grew upright and Christian. He was taken in high regard by all around, quality, tasking, and low. He worked the land like it was his own, and thought our masters might be so struck to grant him freedom, perhaps upon their dying. He was a boy of big thinking. All knew it. Girls fought over that boy's legacy he would not marry. He held for one of high honor and would accept none who measured less than his mother. But she died. My wife, my whole heart, yes, she did. Fever took her from me. Her last injunction upon me was simple. Keep that boy safe. Let him not sell his legacy for wood. I kept to that. I kept him right under true law. And when he took a wife, a girl from up in the cookhouse, it was like the spirit of his mother returned. For the girl was honorable and worked her task in the same spirit as my son. Years passed us by. We was reformed into something new, another family. I was blessed with three grandchildren, but only one, a boy, made it past yearling. When they died, we grieved hard together, for the love flowed between us all was strong, something like that River James. And all of that love was given to that one who survived. But the land was not what it had been. And the quality took up a new trade, and the trade was us. And each week when we counted, we saw hands fading away. Then, one evening after the count, the head man come and addressed me alone. He say, "All of us round these parts done long felt you a good man. You and your folk are as children to us, near to our heart. But you have heard the soil that is now bearing a song of death. It breaks me all to pieces to say this, but we must part with your boy. I am sorry. It is for the good of us all. I come to you to tell you first so that I am honorable. We have done all we can to assure him some comfort. Best I can do is send his wife and boy along with him. It's all I got."
I was now standing myself. I was watching the old man for fear that he might tumble. The light from the parlor was still glimmering, the laughter had grown a little lower, and there were fewer voices to be heard now.
"When they told me that, I went to nothing," he said. "I walked back to my quarters. I was trembling. My sight was going black. I walked out into the woods to address the Lord, but I tell you, I could not speak. I slept out there and did not come to the fields in the morning. They must have known I was grieving, for the head man never came for me. That day I wandered the near country with only my thoughts. I walked, but never ran. A notion gnawed in me. These people were so low that they would divide a father from his only son. I knew what I was. My whole life was purchased on time. I was born in the varmint trap. But there was no way out. It was my life. But no matter how much I said it, a powerful part of me had never believed. Then they took my boy. I come in that night and face him. I told him what they said. His face was a rock. Yes, it was. He ain't show no fear. He was too strong. And his strength broke me down, and I wept. Don't cry, Pap, he said. Some way or the other, we shall have our grand meeting.
2 days later, the head man sent me on an errand to town. But before I go, I see a familiar buggy and a horse up at the house. And out from that buggy come Riley. And I knew the time of parting was upon us. I walked off trying to comfort myself in the knowing that my boy would have a good wife and they should blossom as natural. But when I get back, his wife was still there and my boy was gone. At night I come to her, a rage growing in me, and she say they took my son and her baby, that Ryland would not carry them all. And that girl broke down right there in front of me, crazed, wailing. When she regained herself, when she stood, I did not see her face. I saw a haunt of my wife. And I then recalled her injunction upon me. Keep that boy safe. That's how I knew my time was all about done. For a man that cannot honor his wife's dying wish ain't even a man. Ain't even alive. The girl said she could not live. She had other family and seen many of them go that way down Natchez. None could know who would be next. By what cause should we live out of connection? The tree of our family was parted, branches here, roots there, parted for their lumber. We were crazed in our grieving, I tell you. The girl took my hand, and when she turned, I again saw the face of my wife. She led me out into the night. She walked to the cookhouse, and I knew just what she planned. They would have skinned us alive. I dragged her back and put her to bed. When morning came, she was back to herself. And she put on that very same costume that all us Tuscan folk must wear to live.
I knew the ideas of the old man's son, and saw myself in his ambitions, in his notions that he might prove himself noble and thus achieve his feelings. It was not so hard to understand. But the task does not bargain, does not compromise. It devours.
Time came. She was grateful for my wisdom, if you might name it such. We were joined by our grief. Our family is gone from us. And living each alone in Virginia was a life we could not do.
And here the old man paused, and I had that awful feeling of knowing precisely what he would say before he said it.
It was natural that I love her. It is natural for a man and woman to make family,
he said.
Upon that great stead with all our people shipped out from us, it is natural that we would be together. And we were together. For some years, I will not disavow it. I will not denounce her. I will say I have sinned in a world of terrible sinners, that this world is constructed to divide father from son, son from wife, and we must bite back with whatever a blade we have at hand. One day, a white man who'd long moved his property to Mississippi returned. Said he'd sold his plot for he could not reconcile himself to such a savage people. He returned with men, and among these men, I learned, was my beloved son. Right then, right there, I knew I could not live. A man returns from the grave to find his father has taken his wife. It could no way be me. That night I went to the cookhouse as my daughter, as my new wife, had once thought, and set it to flame. I knew what they would do to me. It must be done. But before they did, I would atone for my portion, and I would bite back.
And so they beat you on instruction of your master? I asked.
They beat me because they can, he said. Because I am old and will fetch no price. Some day the ghost shall give me up, I know it. But who will greet me in that after?
And now he began to slide down against the bars of the cell.
I heard weeping, and I went to him. He fell into my arms and looked up at me and asked,
"What will the mother of my only son say to me? Will she know that I have done it as best it came to me? Or will she, who charged me so, who charged me with a task no colored can bring, turn from me forever?"
I did not answer. I had no answer. I helped him stand, and felt his skin like cracked leather that only barely held in his bones. I walked him over to his pallet and laid him back down, and I listened as he wept softly, repeating over and over,
"Oh, who will greet me in that after?"
And I listened until he fell asleep. And when I fell asleep after him, I dreamed again of that same field I'd seen months ago, a field of my people with Maynard, who was my brother, holding the chain. The boy went first. I saw him taken in a coffle of coloreds headed west. I saw him from the back courtyard where they had brought us, as they did from time to time to endure yet again our own appraisal and inspection. His mother walked slowly next to the coffle, in step with her son. She was not chained. She was silent and in all white. And when she could, she touched the boy's shoulder, clasped an arm, or held his hand. The train disappeared down the road. It was morning. The day was clear. I was still out in the yard, being handled, being molested, violated, robbed. I was trying so hard to fall back into my mind, to not be there. But the sight of that boy, disappearing in the train down the road, and the sight of his mother, so familiar from some other life, pulled me back. A half hour after the train had disappeared, I was still in the yard when I heard wailing, shrieking, and looking over I saw that the boy's mother had returned.
"Damn you, child killers," she cried. "Damn you who have murdered my boys. Hell upon you, say I. May a just God scatter all of your animal bones."
Her wailing cut the air and the courtyard turned to her. She was walking toward us, shrieking, cursing Rylan and all who should enter the savage trade. So many of us who went with dignity and respect, and it occurred to me how absurd it was to cling to morality when surrounded by people who had none. And seeing this woman, crying out, inconsolable, summoning the wrath of God, gave me heart. She seemed to grow as she came toward us, her every step shaking the ground, I thought, so that even these jackals of the South halted their business to look. A young mother had gone down the road, but something else had come back. Her hands were talons. Her hair was alive and inflamed. Rylan met her at the fence. She clawed at his eyes. She caught his ear in her teeth. He yelled with pain. Soon others came, overtook her, threw her to the ground, kicked her, spat upon her. I did nothing. Understand that I saw all of this, and I did nothing. I watched these men sell children and beat a mother to the ground, and I did nothing. They dragged her away, one hound pulling each arm. Her white garments now ripped and dirty. As they dragged her off, I heard her holler almost in rhythm and melody like the old work songs.
"Murderer, I say! Auctioneer of all my lost boys! Ryland's hounds! Ryland's hounds! May a righteous God rend you to worm's meat! May black fire scorch you down to your vile and crooked bones!"
The old man went next. They took him out for their amusements one night and never returned him. He made his confession before me, and having done as such, he might now go to his reward. Nothing so simple for me. My task had only just begun. I was there for 3 weeks. I was starved and thirsted. They kept us just hardy enough to make us work, and just hungry enough to make us miserable. I was rented out across the county for various tasks. I cleared frozen ground. I emptied outhouses and drove night soil.
I hauled corpses and dug graves. In those weeks, I watched a great number of coloreds, man, woman, and child, brought through and sold off. I was surprised to have remained so long. I began to suspect that I had been singled out for some especial point of torment. I was young and strong and should have fetched a price within days. But the days went on, and people went on, and I remained. Finally, just as the first hints of spring made themselves known, a buyer appeared. Ryland brought me out in chains. I was blindfolded and gagged. I heard one of my jailers say,
"Well now, fella, you have paid quite the price, I know, but I reckon that you have got the upside of this entire bargain. This boy is young, healthy. Should be worth 10 hands out in the field."
There was a silence for a moment. Then another of my jailers spoke.
"We held him far longer than any man should. We had most of Louisiana looking after this boy. Hell, Carolina, too."
I felt rough hands on me. Someone was inspecting me. I had adjusted to it by then, and that alone is the worst of it, that a man could feel his violation as natural. But it was different now because I was blindfolded and could neither see the prospective buyer nor anticipate where he might place his hands.
"And you have been paid well for your time and troubles," the buyer said, "but not for your manners nor conversation. Leave me with what is justly mine, and I shall leave you to your work."
"Just making talk," he said, "just making it all cordial."
"But no one asked you," said the man.
All conversation ended there. I was hoisted, like the thing I was, into the back of the carriage. I saw nothing through my blinds, but I felt the carriage moving at a rapid clip, and for hours there were no words or whispers from the driver. Just the random sounds of the woods and the road rumbling beneath us, until we reached a portion of the path where the carriage slowed, and I could feel us going up and over several hills. Then we came to a stop. I was hoisted out, hands worked at my bindings, my arms were freed, my eyes unmasked. I was on the ground. I looked up and saw it was night, and then I saw my capturer. I had imagined him a giant, but now I saw him to be average-sized and unremarkable, an ordinary man. The dark was too thick to make out any features, and at all events there was no time to make a survey. I tried to stand, but my legs went wobbly and I fell. Then I stood again, but this time my capturer gave a gentle shove and I fell back, but instead of hitting the ground where I might have expected my feet to have been, I fell farther. And looking up again, I saw that I was in a pit. Then I heard the door to the pit into which I had fallen close over me. Again, I rose, my feet unsure, the ground wobbling under me, barely upright before my head touched against a hard earthen roof. I reached out and found walls of roots and wood, which kept the earth around me at bay. I took the measure of my dungeon. It was about my height, perhaps double in length and width. The darkness was total beyond blindfolds, night, and perhaps blindness itself. A kind of death. I thought of Marvel's Book of Wonders, the entry of oceans, how their mass could swallow whole continents, which themselves could swallow some innumerable quantity of me. I saw myself as a child on the library floor, marshaling all my powers to count the breadth of the ocean, until my head throbbed at the limits of perception. And I felt at that moment, down in that darkness, in that seeming death, that I was lost in an ocean, a body sinking in the great surf. I had heard stories of white men who bought colored simply to enact their wildest pleasures, white men who kept them locked away for the sheer thrill of being able to, white men who bought coloreds for the ecstasy of murder, white men who bought coloreds to cut on them for experiments and demon science. And I felt then that I had now fallen to such a white man, that I was now subject to the perfect vengeance of Virginia, Elm County, my father, and little May. Chapter 11. Time lost all meaning. Minutes could not be discerned from hours, and with neither sun nor moon, day and night became fictions. At first I took note of the odor of the earth, the occasional sounds above, but soon enough, it is impossible to say when, they became useless noise to me. The wall between sleep and the waking world dissipated, so that dreams were indistinguishable from the figments and illusions that now began to bedevil my mind. I saw so many things down there, so many people. And among those visions, one in particular assumed a special importance, because among all the visions that came over me, this one would soon reveal itself to be no device, but true memory. We were young, and I was in my first year of service to my brother. It was a long summer Saturday, and the masters of Lochless had become bored, which brought to their normal oppressions an element of novelty and whimsy. And so Maynard, who was a child, had a perverse notion to gather all the tasks up from out of the warrens and have them assemble on the bowling green. He ordered me to spread the word. So I did this, and within half an hour or so I had them all out on the green, where it was announced by Maynard that the gathered tasks, old and young, some freshly exhausted from the field, others in the overcoats and polished shoes of the house, would race each other for his amusement. On the possible scales of humiliation and measured against all the troubles put upon us back then, this would not be the worst. But it was humiliation, and what doubled it for me was that I had not yet understood my place among things, for as I watched Maynard organize them into packs to run against each other, he called to me, "What are you doing, huh? Get down here." I looked for a moment, not comprehending. "Get down here," he said again. And it occurred to me what he meant. I was to run too. I had just that year been brought out of my lessons with Mr. Fields. I remember the eyes of everyone assembled directed toward me, and what I saw in them was both sympathy for me, perhaps unearned, and disgust for Maynard. So I was lined with three of the others, and off we went in the August heat to the edge of the field. By the time we'd turn to run back, I was past them all, for while I cannot speak for them, I really was running, running so hard that when my foot caught itself in something hard protruding up from the ground, a rock, an old tree root, I flew off the ground and straight into the field. I hobbled my way back to the starting line, where I found Maynard, laughing in a great mood, organizing the next group. For the next 3 weeks, I moved through the house discharging my duties, limping, and every step I took, the sharp pain in my ankle was a constant reminder of my state. This vision replayed itself for me as though on some sort of carousel, interspersed with others of Thina, Old Pete, Lem, and the woman dancing on the bridge, my mother. But mostly there was darkness. Total darkness. Until at some point, hours, days, weeks after I had been deposited there, I saw a slice of light cut its way through the ceiling of my dungeon. I scurried back almost rat-like into the farthest corner of my box. And then there was a sound, something dropping to the ground, and a voice bellowing out to me. "Come out," said the voice above me. "Come out." I walked over and touched the rungs of the ladder. Looking up, I saw the light of dusk, and against it, the outline of that ordinary man who brought me there, my warden. "Come out," he said. I climbed up. When I reached the top, I did not so much stand before this ordinary man as I hunched. We were in a small clearing in the woods. In the distance I saw the last orange breath of the dying sun pushing out over the dark fingers of the woods. In this clearing, my captor had arranged an absurd reception. 2 wooden chairs, a table between them. He motioned to one of the chairs, but I would not sit. The ordinary man turned, walked toward the other chair, turned back to me and tossed a package my way. I reached to catch it, felt it slip from my fingers, then scoured the ground to retrieve it. a piece of bread wrapped in paper. I gobbled it down and in that instant knew I had never truly experienced hunger until my time down in that pit. However long I had gone without food, it had been long enough that the pangs of famish had faded from me, like a visitor who ceases to knock upon realizing no one is home. But the morsel of bread revived my hunger. I seized up and convulsed, and then, looking at the table, I saw more packages and something more essential, a jar of water. I did not even ask. I scampered over and drank and let the water wash down my throat and around the side of my mouth, down my neck, and onto my long shirt and overcoat, which I now caught the pungent odor of. The world of feeling began to come back to me. I was hungry and terribly cold. I unwrapped another piece of bread quickly, devoured it, and then another, and was going for another when this ordinary man quietly said, "That will be enough." I turned and saw that he was seated not too far from me. And though it was dusk, it was already too dark for me to get the full features of his face. The ordinary man sat there in his chair, saying nothing. I waited there, shivering against the cold. Then I saw a light in the distance growing larger and approaching us. I heard wagon wheels crunching against the road until a large, covered car and horse stood before us. A man next to the driver held a lantern. The driver stepped off and nodded to the ordinary man, who then beckoned me to board the wagon. I climbed up and saw now that there were several other colored men in the car. And then we were off, rumbling down the road, the wagon shifting and creaking under us. I examined the other men gathered there and wondered what depredations might now greet us. And there were no chains. Who would need them? For had you seen the bowed heads around me, you would have known that these men were more than bonded. They were broken. And I was one of them, so tumbled into the pit of despair that all my disparate motives had been reduced to survival. I had been reduced to an animal. Now came the hunt. We rode for an hour or so, and then were ushered back out the wagon, placed into file. And we stood there in ungainly ranks, the ordinary man surveying us as a general might review a fresh round of recruits. And though it was darker now, I found that the darkness suited my eyes, as though the time below had somehow changed me so that the moonlight proved enough for me to now take the measure of this ordinary man, his hair hanging long and ungainly beneath his wide-brimmed hat, and a long gray beard raw and untamed sprouting from his face. There were more of us than him at that moment, however beaten down and demoralized we were. But we knew he wasn't alone, because white men in Virginia are never really alone. And then the others arrived, announcing themselves by lantern light in the distance and the approaching clomp and clack of horse hooves and wheels creaking up the road. And now I saw three carriages pulling to a stop before us, and from them white men disembarked, holding the lanterns in their hands. The light cast a yellow pall upon them, and they seemed otherworldly, creatures of another age, demons, gorgons, specters, summoned back to wreak the vengeance of quality upon our persons. But then I heard them talk, and I heard a particular cadence that told me that I was still in Virginia, and these creatures were no conjuration but a pack of low whites. Their talk was rough. Their coats were worn. Now my heart dropped, and a new wave of fear overtook me. The monsters of myth would have been preferable to these men I knew too well. The low whites enjoyed only a toehold in the craggy face of society, an insecure position, which only augmented the brutal spirit they so often visited upon the coloreds of Virginia. This brutality was the offering quality made to the low whites, the payment that united them. And it struck me now that this was the point of our evening, a ritual of brutality in which we, the captured, were to be the sacrifice. The ordinary man extended brief pleasantries to the low whites and once again walked down the line and made an appraisal of us. There was something theatrical about him now, and whereas before he had seemed solemn and reserved, now he was boastful and preening, He reached into his coat and pulled on his suspenders. He would stop, assess a man, shake his head mockingly, and suck his teeth. And then, having assessed us again, he spoke.
"Villains of Virginia," he bellowed, "judgment has now set its blind gaze upon you. Thieves, robbers, murderers, villains who have compounded your crimes by connivance to escape our laws and pass into another land under false and assumed names."
Again he walked the line, but this time he stopped before one of the men farther down the line to my left.
"You, Jackson, talked of murder of your master, but talked too much, boy. You were given up and now must stand before Virginia justice."
The ordinary man moved down.
"And you, Andrew, thought you could make off with some portion of your master's cotton crop, did you? And when found out, decided you might run."
Andrew stood solemn and silent. The ordinary man moved on.
"Davis and Billy," he said, now walking to the other end of the line, "why, boys, I'm told